Sunday I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sunday.
I have no idea where I'm going to go tonight. I'm kind of in one of those weird moods, so I could go all over the place. I chaired a meeting Friday night, and the first two people passed, they had absolutely no idea where I had gone or been or talked about, so hopefully I'll do a little better than that tonight. But I'm not going to promise anything. It's funny. There was a long time, when I first came into AA I went to some speakers' meetings, not many, and I never wanted to speak because when people come up and speak, a lot of times they have these really cool stories. I mean, their drunk-alongs are like, they've done everything. We were talking about that before the meeting started, and mine's kind of boring, so I'm really sorry, but I will try to explain a little bit about what makes me an alcoholic. People used to get up and they would say, I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I mean, I went to meetings and I heard how it works. I didn't realize that's where they got that from. I thought they had really wise sponsors and their sponsors told them that this is what they were to say. Well, they might have, but I didn't realize that it actually says that and how it works. So I am going to try to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was thinking this week, it's funny, I hate to think about before I get ready to speak because I can really go off on a lot of tangents, but I was thinking about as a very young child what I was like, and growing up, now I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. My mother said if my father drank the way he ate, he would have been an alcoholic, but I never saw him drink much. There were some stories about his drinking which might lend me to believe that he was perhaps an alcoholic, but I don't know that for sure, and I don't really dwell on that too much. But our family, we were not Leave It to Beaver. You know, we didn't have the perfect family. My family fought a lot. They argued a lot. They yelled a lot. It was a loud family a lot of times. And so I would escape, and I escaped to the basement. Everybody lived on the top floor, and then the basement was, unfinished and had lots of junk in it, and that junk was my castle, so to speak. They say some men's junk is another person's treasure. Well, I had lots of treasures down there. And my middle sister I would go to her and I'd go, I want you to do something. She wanted to be an interior designer or decorator. So she would go downstairs with that junk and she would build a house for me or whatever it was that was in her mind. And then she'd come and she'd get me from upstairs and she'd take me down and she'd give me the scenario and I would play all afternoon down in that basement. I could control that. That is one place that I could control. And I think as I got older, you can't continue to play children's games, and so you have to find other ways to deal with life on life's terms. And at 13, I love this story because it's just so, at 13, I wanted to be, I was a fairly good student. I did cheerleading, I did all the right things, and outwardly I looked okay, but that's not who I wanted to be. I wanted to be a bad girl. I was just like I was a pretty good kid, and I never wanted to be that. I wanted to be something else, and so I wanted to hang with the bad people, but I always hung with the good people. So I got invited to go out with two what I would consider the bad girls, two of the bad girls, and I don't even know why they invited me to go. But they were going to camp out. And so prior to camping out that night, we found two boys that were 21 or 22 years old. I was 13. We were 13. We were in eighth grade. And they bought us each a bottle of Boone's Farm wine. And mine was Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. I remember. I love strawberries, so that's what I chose. And I don't know what the others chose, but I guess that's very important. Anyway, so that night we got back to where we were going to go camping in the back of Heidi's yard. didn't want to go too far, And, we'd set up our tent and we were ready to go. And I think they brought us the wine. I don't think we actually had it at that point. I think they brought it to us there. And so I proceeded to drink. And I'm here to tell you, I drank the whole bottle. I mean, that was my first unsupervised drink of alcohol. And it never occurred to me that you drink you know, well, we didn't have a glass, so, you know, that my glass was the bottle, so I just assumed you finished the whole thing. I mean, that's, you know, one container. So, so I got pretty drunk, but what happened even more than that for me was things changed. I became more beautiful. I became somebody that another man wanted. He was 22, for God's sake, and I was 13. And I got French kissed for the first time by this older man. I was like, oh, my God, I have just arrived. I mean, it was just like, it was heaven. Luckily for me, he must have been a halfway decent guy. Either that or I passed out, and he said, well, forget this. But they left at some point in the night. I don't know. I mean, I guess I was kind of fortunate. And the next day, when we got up, I don't know why we went to a graveyard down the road. We went for a little walk down to this graveyard. And I knew that I could drink because they were throwing up in the graveyard. And I did not feel like throwing up. I mean, I was okay with that. So I felt like not only had I arrived and now I was glamorous, but I could also hold my alcohol. And from that point on, I wanted to drink. I wanted to be able to drink. And, of course, I'm 13 years old. I can't drink all the time. But any time there was an opportunity to drink from that point on, I drank. And whenever I drank from that point on, I got drunk. That was a foregone conclusion. Now, I didn't think that that was a foregone conclusion, but looking back on my drinking career, that was a foregone conclusion, that that's what was going to happen. There were times, and I've heard both ends of the spectrum. I've heard people say some people never tried to control their drinking at all. But there were times, I guess, when I had maybe still a little control. If I knew that all I was going to be able to drink was two drinks, or I was not going to be able to drink as much as I wanted to, I did not drink. I chose not to because I knew that once I started drinking, I knew I was going to get drunk. Now, I really didn't know I was going to get drunk. I just knew somehow intuitively that I couldn't handle that kind of situation. I wasn't going to like it, so I just didn't do it. So I would wait until I could drink as much as I wanted to. And as life went on, I had lots of opportunities to drink as much as I want to. I'm not a big blackout drinker. I did have some blackout drinking. I went to Virginia Tech, and one night, one of the guys that worked in the dining hall with me, I got a big mouth, but I don't drink but so much. Anyway, I told him, I said, I can drink you under the table. He said, oh, yeah. I said, oh, yeah. So we went out to drink. I blacked out after the first beer that night. I'd never done that before. And the rest of the night, I don't know about until the next morning I woke up. And I was in a dorm room, and I was in the top bunk, which was where I slept, but the walls were not my walls. And I kind of peeked down over the edge, and I was in the guy that I went to, I was in his room, and he was a ROTC, so I was in the ROTC dorm at Virginia Tech, which could have gotten him in a lot of trouble, could have gotten me in a lot of trouble, and so he snuck me out, and he was like on the third floor, so we had to come down and get out of the ROTC dorm, and I had to ask him what happened. Well, he actually told me what happened. He said, I appreciate you cussing out my best friend. I said, oh, really? And we had gone to another bar, we had gone motorcycle riding, we had done all these things, and I don't remember any of it, and I'm like, God, man, I didn't have any fun. But he, from that point on, he called me the sailor. And so that was my nickname because not only, well, I have a trash mouth, I have to tell you. And when I drink, my mouth is really trashy. So he just called me the sailor. He said I could cuss better than any of the other ROTCs that he knew. So, and I guess when I'm a blackout, I really do it well. So anyway, so I continued to drink in college and then, you know, left and I'm an educator by profession and started to teach. I taught a little bit in Norfolk. Didn't drink a lot that year, my first year out. I was a long-term substitute and didn't have a lot of opportunities to drink. But when I did drink, I got drunk. I mean, that patterns, you know, was just always there. And then I moved to Nelson County and got a full-time job as a teacher. And that's when I could drink anytime I wanted to then. I was an adult You know, I could buy alcohol. I could drink whenever I wanted to, and I drank a lot. And I don't even know some days how I got up and went to work, because I would drink until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I'd go home, and I would get up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go to work. And it's funny, I don't think of myself as a liar, a cheat, and a thief, but there were times when they would, like if you're getting observed by an administrator, one of the administrators came to me and he said that he was coming in to observe me. And I said, oh. And he said, and where's your lesson plans? Because we were supposed to have them and have them all written out and everything ready. And I said, oh, my God, I left them at home. I didn't leave them at home. I never did them. You know, I mean, I was not the most prepared educator on this earth. So so I would lie, you know. I mean, I am a liar. And he just kind of smiled. He knew. It's like I knew he knew I was lying, but he didn't call me on it. He said, well, just bring it in tomorrow, which, of course, I never brought it in because I never wrote him up. But I got lucky a lot of times. I mean, I could play my way through stuff. So I'm so grateful today that I'm not drinking. I don't think I could do my job today if I was drunk. I think I would have lost my job a long time ago. But I continued to drink. I went through a divorce. And here's the difference, you know, in the way we think about drinking. I think, you know, we talk about it's a disease of perception. When I'm looking at the world, and I'm trying to deal with the world, I don't deal with it well sober. So when I put alcohol in my system, it allows me to deal with those things that come up. So when my husband came to me and said that he wanted a divorce, that he had found somebody else, that somebody else was a man, I used that as an excuse. Now, I'm telling you, other people would go through something like that, and they would be devastated, and they would be, you know, but they wouldn't necessarily spend their life drinking about it, you know. But that's what I do. I don't know how to deal with those things. I go straight to the bottle. It gave me a reason to drink and drink more. You know, that was my excuse, but I just needed to drink to deal with life. And so I continued. I drank a lot. I mean, that was, for me, when it started to go downhill, it went down very, very quickly. I mean, it was always there. I was always kind of getting a little worse, a little worse, a little worse, but that was the point for me that things just took a nosedive. And I ended up getting into some very weird relationships, and that's my big downfall. Relationships, I don't do them well. Okay, I don't care who you are. I don't do friendships well sometimes. I don't do male-female relationships well. And so I was in the last relationship that I was in. I was dating another guy, and I met this other guy. And in a drunken dispute that the first guy and I had, because it's going to sound weird, all right, I'll try to make sense. He said, you ought to be with the other guy. Y'all like the same music. Y'all like some. And in my drunken mind, I go, well, you know, he's right. So I leave his house, and I go, I know where this other guy lives, and I go to this guy's house, and I'm drunk, and I go up to it, and I knock on the door to tell him I have now arrived, you know, like you know, I don't know. Anyway, and this elderly gentleman opened the door, and I went, oh, shit. I mean, I did. I mean, that's because it was his father. I had no idea. This was his parents' house. He didn't own his own house. He's a drunk just like me. You know, we don't have a whole lot, you know. And so there's his dad. Well, here's the interesting thing. I'm drunk. I mean, you know, drunk females, I'm sorry, ladies. We don't look very good when we're drunk. But I must have looked like gold to him. He was so glad that his son had found a woman and was dating, which he hadn't found him. I mean, he didn't know he had found me yet, I guess. And he's like, oh, I'll go get him. And I'm sitting there going, I don't even know if this guy's going to remember who I am. You know, I like met him once. You know, and just anyway, so that's the way my mind goes. And he called up to his son, and luckily he remembered who I was. Of course, first thing he said is, you want a beer? Yes. So we take off to go to the bar and get drunk. That was a very volatile relationship, and that relationship got me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and which is, you know, they say, you know, we have angels. He was sort of like the devil and the angel on both ends. We did have a very volatile relationship and a very angry relationship. And in the end, he ended up beating me up and about 2 weeks later taking me to my first AA meeting. So who knows how things are going to happen. I mean, I don't do relationships like normal people do relationships. It's just the way it goes. So maybe this was the first surrender for me. I had taken out what are the warrants that you call when you're trying to keep somebody away from you? A restraining order. I took out a restraining order on him, and I gave him the name only. I gave him his dad's name. I mean, they had the same name, only Junior the second, so they handed it to his dad, not to him. So anyway, so when he came back into town, I went to see him, and what I wanted from him was I wanted him to, you know, tell me what an awful person he was and how bad he had been and what. And instead, he looked at me and he said, "I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous." I was like, "Ugh." And he said, "I have a problem with alcohol." And I'm thinking, I know that. And then he looked at me and he said, "Don't you think you have one too?" He is the only person who could have said that to me that I would have believed. That I knew how I drank. Nobody, well, maybe others did, but to me, he was the only one that really knew how I drank. I can't tell you the relief to go, yes. I mean, I'd known I'd had a problem with alcohol. I didn't know how to quit. I just didn't have a clue what you did. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that it existed somewhere out there, but not for me. I mean, it never occurred to me that that would be a place I could go. So I went to my first, I'm from Nelson County, or was it living in Nelson County then, went to my first meeting in North Carolina, just not to be too close to home. And and he was working down there on the boats, on a fishing boat. So that's actually why I ended up down there. But I'm not sure I could have stepped into an AA meeting in Nelson County right away. So he was going to take me to this meeting, and either in Nag's Head or Manio. Now, I would have told you it was Manio, but it might have been a Nag's Head. Anyway, what I remember was there was a girl that was about probably the same height. I always think people are shorter than I am, and then I find out later they're taller than I am. But she was blonde hair, had hair to here, about shoulder length, and maybe a little on the stocky side. And it's funny, I can kind of bring her to mind when, and she came up and she gave me a hug and she said, "I'm glad you're here." And I didn't know what to expect in an AA meeting. I was quivering inside. I was like, oh, my God. I thought all of you guys were going to – I thought you all were all going to have, you know, trench coats on that were really dirty and you know, probably bottles in your, you know, Wild Irish Rose or Mad Dog 20 – I don't know if I knew Mad Dog 2020 existed. But anyway, I just thought I was going to – y'all were going to be – not clean, not, you know, I mean, just, that's just was my picture of what an alcoholic should be, somebody that lived under a bridge, blah, blah, blah. And so I come into this meeting, and there was a guy there that had lived under a bridge, and he shared part of that and when they were going around the room and speaking, and I thought, oh, my God, he was clean. He had on regular clothes. He spoke well. I mean, and this guy had lived under a bridge, and I thought, oh, my God. Now, if he can get sober and not drink, I think I can do that, too. I mean, there was hope there for me, you know, in hearing that man share. And when they came to me, and I think everybody was, I don't think it was a real big meeting, and I was able to say, I'm sending him an alcoholic. I never had a problem with that. Other people I've heard, you know, when they first came in, they had to listen for a while before they could say that. It was almost a relief to know that that was the problem. You know, that it wasn't that I was crazy, you know, because I was nuts when I came in. So that was my first AA meeting. At the end, that same girl came up and she hugged me and she said, "Keep coming back." And I did. I went down to Nag's Head because he was working down there on the boat. So I did go to meetings down there. But then when I came back, I was in counseling around that time at Region 10 in Nelson County. And I remember the lady that I was in counseling with asking me whether or not I thought I had a problem with alcohol. Did I have any problem with alcohol? You know, was that part of the picture? And I said, oh, no, not at all. And I would leave there and go drink. So I went back to her and I said, I have something I need to tell you. And she said, what's that? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I could have knocked her over with a feather. She said, what makes you think that? And I started to tell her the truth about my drinking. And she was like, oh, here's the AA meeting list. And she gave me a list, and I went to my first meeting in Nelson County at Oak Ridge. Oak Ridge is, I have two home groups. I consider Oak Ridge still my home group, but I'm also a home group member at the Buckingham. I just recently kind of signed up there. And what that does for me is it makes me committed. Those are two meetings that are four, actually, it turns out four meetings that I am committed to going to. So Oak Ridge was the first meeting, and I didn't know what a home group was. I think they just sort of said, this was my home group, and this is, you know, this is what you're going to be doing. I said, okay, they let me, and they were so nice. I mean, when they came in, it was a small group. They let me clean the ashtrays. They taught me how to make coffee out of big coffee pots because, you know, that's a job, and it's, you don't know how to do that when you first come in. So they would show me how much coffee to put in. I make very strong coffee, and I would clean up. And this is the thing: my home groups, that Oak Ridge is not a real structured group, and we didn't talk a lot about steps and things there. But what the people in at Oak Ridge did for me, there's a lot of old-timers there, a lot of people with 30, well, now 30-plus years. It's interesting. Now I think about it. They had about a little bit more time than I have now when I first started going to that meeting. And so now they're in, you know, they've got 30 years sobriety, 20-some years sobriety, and they always went to meetings. They didn't miss. You know, so they taught me that, you know, when you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, you go to meetings. And they never missed the Oak Ridge meeting. So I learned how to do that just simply by coming. The other thing they did for me was, you know, I didn't have a problem with the concept of God. And I know people coming in do. But that was not the problem for me. The problem was, what was my God? That I didn't know. I believed that there was a power greater than myself. I didn't have a problem with that. But I did not believe, I didn't quite know what I believed there. And so we would spend hours. There was a gentleman there we would sit and talk for hours about he would tell me about his concept. He gave me books to read. We would just kind of chew things a little bit. And he always had time for me. And he'd call me up at home and he'd go, what are you doing tonight? And I'd go, well, I don't really. Well, we're going to go to a meeting down at, and I'll meet you at, you know, where do you want to meet? Do you want to drive? Do you want me to drive? And we would go to meetings. And so he would take me around. I don't know how much he took me around. I just know it seemed like he always called me. And he always called, and I didn't want to go. And the next thing I know, I'd be in my car, and I'd be at a meeting. So they did that for me, all of them. I mean, all the old-timers did that for me when I first came in. And I'm grateful to them for that and the time that they spent with me. Then I started hearing things about getting a sponsor. And so when I first came in, there were a lot of, I didn't know this. There were a lot of people that were newly sober. See, to me, everybody sounded good, and everybody sounded better than me. And there was a lady there that had a lot of problems with relationships, and I heard her share that. And I thought, this is my sponsor, because I need somebody that, I wasn't hearing that she was having a lot of problems with relationships and didn't have any solutions to the problems. What I heard was I could relate to what she said. So I went up to her after a meeting, and I said, I know that I need to get a sponsor. I hear that everybody needs to do this. So would you be my sponsor? And she looked at me and she said, no. I was like, this is not what they talked about. You know, they said, you need to get a sponsor. They don't tell you that people tell you no when you ask them. And she said, I only have a month's sobriety. She said, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I'm thinking, God, I thought she sounded pretty good. But I said, okay, all right, I get it. So so then I was back at square one, and there was a lady there that had a lot of time. And then all of a sudden, it felt like she was gone for months, but I'm sure it was probably only a couple of weeks, and then she started coming back again, and I finally got up enough nerve, because once you've been shot down, it's kind of hard to get back up and go again. I finally got up enough nerve, and I went up to her, and I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said yes. So one of the things that I've learned since then is not everybody was raised in AA in the big book. you know. But they were raised to help other alcoholics, and that's what my sponsor was willing to do. She was willing to be there for me. She was willing to listen to all of my crap. She's, poor thing, she's to walk the track at the high school. And I would be in my room, and I could see the track in the morning, and I'd get there early. And as soon as I saw Ruth Ann out on the track, man, I'd beeline out of my room and out to the track, and I'd be walking around the track with her, telling her all of my crap as we're going around in a circle. And she would listen to me. I mean, because, you know, I always had lots of stuff going on in my head. So-and-so did this, what am I going to do about that, blah, 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 blah. And she would just listen to me every morning. She probably was out there going, oh, my God, I just wish you'd give me one day where I can just walk this track with nobody there. But I did, you know, people would come looking for me. And I was on the track. But anyway, so I did that. That first year, I walked a lot of circles that first year. But and she did listen to me a lot. And she would, some of the things, she used to say to me, everything's right on schedule. I would go and I'd complain, and she'd say, everything's right on schedule, which I hated hearing, because it was not a good schedule as far as I was concerned. It was, things were not going fast enough. My life was still kind of screwy, and I wanted it to get better. And at some point, I had an opportunity to move to Virginia Beach. Now, I'm moving to Virginia Beach for all the wrong reasons, and we sat there and we talked about it, and finally I said, you know, we were talking about me going, and one of the things that she said was, you know, it might not be a bad place for you to go. There will be more meetings there. There will be big book meetings. There will be 12 and 12 meetings. There will be speaker meetings, and maybe it would be good for you to do that. Now, the reason I was going was because that relationship that got me into AA, didn't get me into AA, but the guy that I was with, I was going down there to be with him. And so she said, and one of the things she told me to do, she said, be ready to run if you need to run. You know, make sure you have a place to go. So I went down there, and I went to very few meetings. And I do not suggest that for anybody. I was probably 2 years sober at that point, and really not very solid at all for me. I wasn't solid. I hadn't done the steps. She told me I'd done 1, 2, and 3. When I asked her about the 4-step, she told me to do an autobiography, which I did, never shared it. She said it didn't matter that I didn't share it because she had already heard everything, so I'm going around that track a million miles a minute. So, of course, never did 6, 7, never did 8, 9, had no clue what 10, 11, and 12 were. So I wasn't versed there. And so I was sober, I think, just by the grace of God. You know, I prayed every morning. I mean, and I did whatever anybody told me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did it. I was willing. I did not want to go back out and I didn't want to go back out again. So I was willing to do what other people said. So I'm one of those people that I stayed sober without the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. And didn't even know it. So that was okay, but I wasn't real solid. And when I got down to Virginia Beach, and things were kind of crazy, and I wasn't going to meetings, I thought about drinking a lot. And I thought, nobody will know, because nobody knows me here. I could drink and nobody would know. And he was going back out. He was a heroin addict, so he had actually started back into heroin. So things got bad, and I ended up having to boot. And I ran to a one-car garage on Baltic Avenue in Virginia Beach. My sponsor said, you need to get back into meetings. And so I started going to some bizarre meetings. There are some good meetings and there are some not so good meetings. But in one of the meetings, there was this curly-haired guy that was in this one meeting that was a little crazy, but when he spoke, he had made more sense than anybody I heard in a while. And it was just kind of like, well, that's kind of cool. And he ended up asking me out, and we ended up, you know, just we're nuts when it comes to relationships, so we ended up living together probably within a week. And I don't do anything well when it comes to relationships, but he ended up being my husband, so that turned out okay. And I guess, yeah, it did. It actually worked out okay. But But did we do it the way probably was the healthy way to do it? No, that's no fun. So anyway, so I got a sponsor down at the beach. We did do, and it's interesting, I just saw her this past weekend, the weekend before last. We were down at the Virginia, at the Oceanfront Conference. And she's gone back. She had to go back out and do a little research and development for many years and then came back. She has 5 years sober now. And we were talking about, I did a four-step with her. I had gone to hear Earl Husband do one of the first pockets, how to do a four-step. And so I'd gone to that. I got 1, 2, and 3, columns 1, 2, and 3, still didn't get 4. I don't know that that mattered at that point in time. I did it to the very best of my ability. I remember calling her up, and she was going out of town. I said, Sharon, so I got my four-step done. I know you're going out of town, so when you get back, just give me a call. And she said, well, I have another day. Just come on over tomorrow. I was like, okay. So I went and I did my fifth step with her. And she asked me, she said, we never did. And she sent me home after I did the fifth step. She sent me home to do 6 and 7. I was exhausted after doing my fifth step. And I went home and I did fifth. And she said, when I finished my fifth step, she looked at me and said, that was easy. I don't have that big a fifth step. Well, I did. Well, it wasn't that big a fifth step. It probably needed to be a little bit bigger. But anyway, but I'd done it. I felt like I had finally done it. And so I went home that night. I bet I spent 5 minutes, fell asleep. But I said the 7-step prayer, fell asleep. And the next morning she said, did that do you any good? Because she realized in talking, I never got to the fourth column, my part in it. That never happened in my first 4-step, as close to the big book as I could do it. And I said, yes, it did, because that next morning when I got up to drive to work, normally on the beltway, I am white-knuckled going, get out of my way. Merle said, I am so focused when I'm driving. I wouldn't know if God was next to me. I mean, I would be white-knuckling all the way. And for the first time, I was calm. There was sort of this peace that I had not felt before. Now, I'm here to tell you, it doesn't last if you don't do 8 and 9, and I didn't do 8 and 9. So, you know, when they talk about, you know, you have to keep, you know, your sobriety's contingent on your fit spirit, on maintenance of your spiritual condition, that to me that is very, very true, and I've had to learn it over a very long period of time how true that is. But anyway, so that was my, and I've never felt that way since then. I've never had that huge sense of relief and peace. That, I mean, it was just a different feeling than anything I've ever had before. So I told her, I said, yes, it did help. And she said, well, we didn't do 8 and 9. I said, no, we didn't. I said, that's why I had to go back later and do all of that. So, but that was okay, because she did the best she could with me. I did the best I could, and there was some relief from having done that. So Merle and I ended up moving back to Nelson County. And I went back to my old sponsor, and somewhere, I don't even remember where, I decided I really wanted to go back to the big book, and I wanted to do the steps according to the big book. And I asked another woman to be my sponsor. And this is why I asked her. This is what I heard her say in a meeting one time. She said, you know, when we're drinking, problems arise. And that's it. We drink over them. And they get either bigger, or maybe they'll go away on their own somewhere. We're hoping they'll go away on their own. But we never find out that problems have a beginning, a middle, and an end. When we get into Alcoholics Anonymous and we get sober, we find that problems have beginnings. They do have middles, sometimes tough, but we finally can get to the end of the problem because we're actually dealing with the problem rather than drinking through the trying to drink the problem away. And I love that. I thought, aha. Because I always thought when I came in that life was going to, you get sober and then this is life. You know, that's what was going to happen. Everything was going to be even. Nothing was going to happen that was going to bother me, upset me. The world was just going to be just at peace because I'm sober. I guess, I don't know. But, and then stuff happens and it's like, you know, the life goes on, and you have to learn to deal with it. And that's what the process of the 12 steps to me does for me. It helps me get through those difficult times. But I have to know the process before I can use them to help me in those situations. So I went to this woman, and I said, would you be my sponsor? And we talked a little bit, and she agreed to do it. But I told her I wanted to do it by the Big Book. And she said, I wasn't raised that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we had gotten some tapes, and this gentleman had taken people through the Big Book. And what she was willing to do with me was we would listen to the tapes, and then we would attempt to do what was in the tapes and to follow that. And she was willing to do that with me. And we got to 8 and 9, and I made some amends from that. So I grew a little bit more in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everybody that I have been in contact with, anybody that has helped me in different ways, in different places, and I'm very grateful for, and particularly, nothing against you guys, but particularly for the women in AA, because I would have said that I liked women, you know, I've always had women friends, blah, 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 you know, I didn't like you guys, because we're competition. I heard somebody say that this weekend, and I thought, that is so true, and I didn't realize that, and she helped me like women. There was something about how she felt very connected to the women in AA. She felt very important that she'd be there for the women in AA, and she taught me that. And that's a very important lesson in Alcoholics Anonymous was for me. So anyway, she is still my sponsor today. I have since, though, and I've talked to her a little bit about this. I'm almost sometimes embarrassed to talk to her about this, even though I know it's what I've needed. Merle and I started going to the meetings in Buckingham, and Buckingham's very structured, very Big Book oriented, and I started hearing people say things that I had never heard before in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I finally went to somebody and I said, if I were going to get somebody to go through the Big Book, who would you suggest? Well, somebody came up to me and actually offered. They said, I'll go through the Big Book with you. Oh my God, it opened it up. I finally understood that fourth column. I'd never understood that before. Because I was doing it, and we were doing a four-step. We went through the whole book, and we got to that, and I did a four-step, and I shared it in the fifth step, and she said, you still got yourself? You still got the other person in it. I'm like, what do you mean? And she said, you're still making them part of the issue. You are the problem. This isn't about you cleaning up your side of the street. It has nothing to do with the other person. You've got to take them out entirely. And so in talking with her, I said, do you mean, you know, and I wish I could give you an example. I can't right now. And she's like, yes, that's it. And I was like, oh, my God. I mean, it's one of those light bulb moments. And then we talked about amends. After I'd done 6 and 7, came back and talked about amends. And I'll tell you, this is something I do. I'm not proud of it, but it is part of my personality. When I don't feel good about myself or I have fears, I have a tendency to talk to somebody else about somebody else. I'll come to you and say, you know, Billy just really pissed me off today. Blah, blah, blah. And I can tear him down. I mean, just tear him down because I've got some fear in there and it makes me feel better. Okay? Well, I do that a lot at work, and it was really eating at me. So that came out in my inventory. And she said, let me go talk to my sponsor and see, you know, as far as 8 and 9, who I should put on the list. And she came back and she said, well, this is what my sponsor says. If you're talking to somebody about somebody else, you need to go to that person and make the amends, not to the person you're talking about, because they don't even know. So you don't want to go to them. That'd be awful. But anyway, so, you know, you want to go to that person and make an amends for what you've done. I said, oh, well. There were some other amends I could make. I made those. Those are not the ones that I made. Well, just recently, I don't like stuff like that. That's incredibly embarrassing. Who in their right mind would truly do something like that? So anyway, so then I went to somebody and I said, you know, I'm always looking for the better over here. So I had decided I was going to change sponsors. And so I asked somebody, and they gave me the name of somebody, and she talked to me, and she said, no, you're not changing sponsors. I said, why not? She said, you know, maybe you need to be there for your sponsor and not vice versa. And I went, no. I didn't think that's the way it went. I thought you were always, they were supposed to be there for you. You weren't supposed to be there for them. What is this deal? You know, it's all about me. It's all about getting, not giving. And I said, okay. I said, but will you help me with, because I'm still confused about some things. She said, sure. And so I guess I call her my spiritual advisor today. She's the one that has helped me in the process of the 12 steps. Okay, so I'm doing a doing a four-step again. I did a fear inventory, folks, that I have never, ever done before. She's actually taken the fear inventory out of the big book, and there are prayers in there. Did you know that? If you did, I didn't. There are prayers in there that you say as you go through each part of it. I never saw that before. I did an inventory this time, and if you had asked me, Cynthia, what do you think about God? I said, God is a loving God. God wants good things for everybody. I didn't think God wanted good things for me. I didn't realize that until I did that fear inventory. I was like, oh my gosh. And you know, here's the thing. If I give it to God, then this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to sprout a halo. I am going to be so good that nobody's going to want to be around me. And I'm going to be this Pollyanna that's just going to be this God-awful person. And I was petrified. Now, I'm here to tell you, I have not sprouted a halo. I will never, my personality is not a Pollyanna personality. It will never be. I am pretty much what you see is what you get, and I still can have a sailor's mouth at times. So I am not a perfect person. But in the far end of that, when it says, what would God have you be? I did that, and then at the end, when you go back, I shared it with her, went back and did 6 and 7, and when I went back, it says, go back over all that again. Look at what you put down on paper, from my resentments, my fear inventory, and I went back and I looked at that, and I went, well, this isn't so bad. God doesn't want me to be a Pollyanna. God really does want good things for me. I didn't realize that, and I didn't realize I didn't know that, and I didn't realize that I didn't believe that until I'd done that fear inventory. Oh, my God. It was just like, well, she, you know, and I had to go back and I had to ask her. I don't know if I can find this really fast because I'm running out of time. When it tells you to go back on the conduct part, I had to call her a couple of times. I don't really think I need to keep doing this. I mean, I've done my fear inventory. I've done my resentment inventory. What is this? They're asking the same questions again. She said, yeah, but if you go back a page, there's a prayer in there. There's a prayer in there, and she said, and I can't find it off the top of my, we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. She said, once you've done that, she said, after that prayer, if you go back and look at what you've already written in the inventory, there may be things that pop out that you didn't get over there, but that prayer is going to open that channel up. I went, okay, all right, now I'll go back and do that. So I went back and did that part. And what came out is the same thing that had come out before. I have a really bad tendency at work to talk about other people to other people. And I was like, God. And when I went to do 6 and 7, I knew I wasn't going to have the willingness. I was like, oh, my God, I do not want to deal with this because that means I know who's going to be on my inventory. Every darn person I've ever worked with is going to be on my inventory, and I do not want to have to go make umpteen gazillion amends. I said, and she said, and then after you've done 6 and 7, you're going to have to write your list. I said, it's going to be long. She said, that's okay. You only have to do one amends at a time. Yeah, all right. Okay, So I looked at 6 and I looked over everything and I knew I wasn't going to be willing. And I said, and it says, pray for willingness. And all of a sudden, I knew I had it. And so I could pray the 7-step prayer. And I prayed that prayer and I felt that sense of, okay, it's going to be all right. And I immediately sat down and made my list. And normally, folks, I would not have called. I would have waited several days or a week or 3 or 4 until long before I'd call her and tell her I have my list. But I called her because I knew if I waited, I would continue to wait. If I put something off for a second, I'm going to put it off forever. And so I called her. She wasn't home. I figured she probably wouldn't be. But she called me back almost immediately. She doesn't do that. And she did. And so we talked about it. And she said, this is what I want you to do. I want you to write down what your amends are going to be. I said, I have no idea how to do this. She told me how to do it. But she said, before you go, you write it down. I thought, she's stupid. I'm telling you. And inside I'm going, and I said, I don't want to do this. She said, that's okay. And I said, I really don't want to do this. And I didn't want to write it down. I really wanted to fight this. I did not want to do this. And I don't know what the difference was the next morning I woke up. I wrote it down. I knew I was going to, we had already discussed it. That I said, she said, find the easiest person. I said, okay. Found the easiest person to make the amends with. And I have made several on my list. I'm here to tell you my list is kind of long, so it's going to take a while to get through it. I have had some phenomenal amends this time around. They have been, people have been gracious. They have been supportive. They have been accepting that I'm a human being and that I'm still going to make errors. That I'm not going to, you know, just because I've done this doesn't mean that I'm Snow White, you know, and that I'm not going to be a jerk sometimes. These are people that don't drink. They seem to understand this stuff. You know, I don't get how they know that stuff. I mean, it's like they were born with it. I don't know why. We're just not, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, so it's been pretty phenomenal for me. In the process of that, I had decided that I was going to do step 11. Now, I do step 11. I'll pray in the morning. I like that part of it. I like the part about the day. If you stop when agitated and you ask God, that way you don't waste as much time. The promises in the day part are wonderful. I love them, you know. But I didn't want to do the nighttime part because that means I have to look at what I've done. So I made myself a book. I stamped it. I do stamping. I made it pretty so that I would like to go to that book. And I have started doing more of that inventory at night. Now, I don't do it perfectly, but I'm doing more than I've ever done in my entire life on the 11th step. And I will tell you what's happened for me, even before doing some of that. And then I'm getting close. By having been willing to go back and do the steps and learn the process, I have found that one of the things when you get to the 12th step, and to help another alcoholic, I actually have something to give that I never had to give before. You know, I'm working with a woman right now, and I'm telling you, to be able to work with somebody that's actually staying sober, you know, it's just like so much fun. It's just better than anything. And she comes to my house. She's committed. She comes Saturdays, and we work in the big book. And, you know, she's been working on stuff, and I've watched her grow. And I've, you know, and she called me the other day for the first time because something crappy was going on. I was like, yeah, because, you know, who wants to call? I don't want to call. I don't call you when I'm feeling crappy or something's going wrong because I don't want you to know that I'm not dealing with things well, you know. But she did, and she was able to laugh about it. And we were able to laugh about the situation, and it was like, how much fun is that when somebody trusts you enough to call you, you know? I would not have had anything to offer if I had not gone through those steps to somebody else, except for what people, you know, except that I do go to meetings regularly, and I, you know, I do that stuff. I don't know where I'd be today if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know where I'd be today if it weren't for the women and the men. I'll share something, you know, because I talk about how important the women are. My first year in sobriety, I was 13th step by a painter. he was 13 stepping me as I was getting sober within that first year. And he kept asking me, I moved to a cabin up in the mountains, way up in the mountains, with my two dogs and my cat. And he kept asking me where this cabin was. Where's your cabin? Where's your cabin? Well, he was married. And I kept skirting the issue and not telling him where I was, where I lived. Well, he found it. I mean, he drove around until he figured out where my cabin was and found it. Almost a year to the day. I had been sober for a year, and he came to my house, scared the bejeebies out of me, because I had no idea. I didn't even know what to do. I had two big dogs, both of them, one on either side of me. Outside on the porch, I never invited him in to the house. And we sat there and talked, I guess, for 2 or 3 hours before he finally got him left. I was like, oh, my God. I called my mother. I said, oh, this is what happened. She said, go to a meeting and share what happened. And she said, and the other thing she told me to do was call him up and tell him never to come to my house again. I didn't know I had a right to do that. I did not know that I had a right to do that. So I called him up, hoping his wife would answer the phone so I could tell her to tell him. Again. But, you know, God has other plans. He answered the phone, and I told him never to come to my house again. And he stopped coming to AA meetings around where I went. But I went to a meeting that night, and I didn't share his name because I didn't think that that was appropriate, but I did share what had happened to me. And I'm going to tell you, the men in that meeting, one of the men asked me, and they said, did you consider not going to AA anymore? And I said, yes. That really ran through my mind. I don't want to deal with this crap. And he said, this kind of stuff happens everywhere, and you need to learn to deal with it. And which is what my sponsor was teaching me how to do, you know, that I had rights, you know. But at the same time, they would have protected me. Those men were angry that that had happened to me. And they were willing to protect me and make sure that that did not happen again. And all of a sudden, I felt very safe in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't some crazy people in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are all crazy when we come in here, you know. But there are a lot of really good, good people. And so I learned to trust the men in Alcoholics Anonymous as well as the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was an incredibly important lesson for me to learn. And that as a woman, I had certain rights, you know. And I'm grateful for that. And as a result, I do not feel uncomfortable. A lot of times at Oak Ridge, not all the time, but a lot of times I'm the only woman there. Doesn't bother me a bit. I don't mind being with you guys, you know. I can cuss just as good as anyone. Can if I need to. But I'm comfortable. I am very comfortable there. I love it when the women are there. Don't get me wrong. That's as good as sliced bread because that's who I'm going to help. You know, that's who I'm going to work with one-on-one. But I'm very comfortable with everybody that walks in the rooms. And I'm grateful for that. I don't know that there's any place else. This is the only place that you can go to meet and they actually listen to you. You guys aren't sitting there talking to each other because you're bored to tears. It's time to go. Yeah, let's get done. This doesn't happen any place else in the world. I mean, I go to meetings at work and people talk to each other all the time through meetings. You know, write notes back and forth. They're very rude. And this is where I learned not to be rude in a meeting. You know, how to behave myself. And you guys taught me those things. So I'm grateful for that. I've learned a lot in here and I really appreciate you all coming out in this messy weather tonight. And drive safely home. Thanks. Thank you.